identify key influencers who tweet who are attending and create a list so you can easily follow them. Check hashtags and become an active part of the conversation while in sessions. Take pictures of the people you meet and the parties and sessions you attend, both for tweeting and to help you remember. Take notes on everything, and when the event is over, whip it all into a story or a photo series for posting on your blog, emailing to people you met, pushing out through Facebook, etc. Pro tip, don't wait until 2 weeks after the conference. Do it on the plane home and get it out immediately so that it gets to people while they're still fresh from the conference high. Master the deep bump. The bump is the main weapon in your conference commando arsenal. Reduced to its essence, it is the 2 minutes you're given with someone you're bumping into, whom you are looking to meet. Your goal should be to leave the encounter with an invitation to reconnect at a later time. The bump, like other practices, is nuanced. The perfect bump is one that feels both fast and meaningful at the same time. I call this ideal a deep bump. Deep bumps are an effort to quickly make contact, establish enough of a connection to secure the next meeting, and move on. You've just paid a boatload of money to be at this conference, unless you're a speaker, when it's usually free, and you want to meet as many people as you can in the time that you have. You're not looking to make a best friend. You are looking, however, to make enough of a connection to secure a follow-up. Creating a connection between any two people necessitates a certain level of intimacy. In 2 minutes, you need to look deeply into the other person's eyes and heart. Listen intently. Ask questions that go beyond just business. And reveal a little about yourself in a way that introduces some vulnerability. Yes, vulnerability, it's contagious, into the interaction. All these things come together to create a genuine connection. Not possible, you exclaim. Ah, but I've seen it done, and I do it. The deep bump is not just theoretical mumbo-jumbo. There are some people who need just seconds rather than minutes to pull off a deep bump. Former President Bill Clinton, for instance, is the master. I've watched him up close as he works a line of well-wishers and fans, and sometimes strident opponents. With each person, President Clinton will reach out to shake his or her hand. Most of the time, he'll use two hands or clasp a person's elbow to create instantaneous warmth. He'll make direct eye contact, and in that fleeting moment, ask a personal question or two. I don't know how many times I've heard people from the same event comment about how incredible it was to be the sole focus of the man's attention, and that's even the Republicans. The profoundness of that connection doesn't come from the president's desire to impart his opinion or riff on policy. His goal is at once very simple and powerful. The president wants you to like him. So in his now famous words, he feels what you feel. When he shows in those brief moments that he likes and cares about you, the human response is to reciprocate. He is finely tuned in to the radio station that we each listen to, WIIFM, also known as What's in It for Me. I never once heard Clinton ask for a vote or talk about himself when engaged in these quick, casual encounters. His questions always revolved around what the other person was thinking, what was troubling them. Most people think a conference is a good time to market their wares. They rush from room to room, desperately trying to sell themselves. But a commando knows that you have to get people to like you first. The sales come later. In the follow-up discussions you have after the conference, now is the time to begin to build trust and a relationship. Know your targets. You're ready to bump. Now you just need someone to bump against. At each conference, I keep a list of 3 or 4 people I'd most like to meet on a folded piece of paper in my jacket pocket. I check off each person as I meet them. Beside their name, I'll jot down what we talked about and make a note about how I'm going to contact them later. And once you've met with and engaged someone, you find yourself chatting again and again throughout the conference. You can't, however, rely solely on chance to find them at cocktails or on a break. I usually ask the conference organizer to point to the area where they'll be, and I watch where they sit. Most people continue to sit in the same seats throughout the conference. For example, Barry Diller, the CEO of Interactive Corp, was someone I'd wanted to meet for years. He's a visionary in commerce and media with an uncanny ability to foresee, before anyone else, where innovation will turn into profit. He smells money. Researching one of my conferences, I noticed he was scheduled to speak. I found out when and where and got access to the area where he would have to get on and off the stage. I positioned myself in a place where it would be damn near impossible to get by without giving me a little nudge. As he walked by, I got his attention. "Mr. Diller, my name is Keith Ferrazzi. I work for Barry Sternlicht as his CMO at Starwood. He's mentioned before that you and I should talk, and I thought I'd just make the introduction myself. I know you're busy, but I'm wondering if I can call your office and arrange a time to meet with you when we get back home." Pause, to which he responded, "Sure, call my New York office." "Great. I wanted to talk to you about a number of ideas I have about your business, but I've also admired your career and the pioneering work you've done for a long time." That was it. I played my heaviest and hardest card, which was my boss, a fellow visionary entrepreneur, for whom Diller held respect. With a name as big as Diller, sometimes the bump can't be as deep as you'd like. Still, with limited time, I managed to gain credibility by dropping a familiar and trusted name, show a bit of vulnerability in admitting I admired his career, and suggest I had value to offer with my ideas. That bump went on to realize a job offer and introductions within his company that are still important to my business today. Your soundbite introduction will change depending on the circumstances. Generally, it will be a 2 or 3 sentence opener, tailored to the event, about what you can or want to do for them. Breaks are no time to take a break. Breaks are where the real work happens at a conference. Make sure to stake out the right place. Have you ever noticed how guests gather in the kitchen or some other central place when you have gatherings at home? One warm and centrally located spot is often the center of any party. The same holds true at a business gathering. Determine where most people will gather, or at least pass, and station yourself there. This might be near the food table, the bar, or the reception area. Be on your game during these times. U.S. News and World Report revealed Henry Kissinger's technique for commanding a room. "Enter the room. Step to the right. Survey the room. See who is there. You want other people to see you." Kissinger knows that great networkers know how to make a memorable first impression. They see a room of people as a playing field. Remember to look sharp. Don't underestimate the importance of dressing well in places where you'll be noticed. And start bumping. Follow-up. If you didn't think I was a nut before, now it's a certainty. I know I've told you to follow up already, but that's how vitally important I think this is. So here it is again. Follow up. After that, follow up again. Then, after you've done that, follow up once more. I don't like to put it off, or it might not get done. How many of you have cards from events that occurred months ago or even longer? That's a lost opportunity. During speeches, I'll sit in the back and write follow-up emails to the people I just met at the previous break. Everyone you talked with at the conference needs to get an email reminding them of their commitment to talk again. I also like sending a note to the speakers, even if I didn't get a chance to meet them. Here's an actual example of one of my follow-up emails. Hey, Carla. Wow. What a fun time. I didn't expect tequila shots to be a part of the Forbes CIO conference. We definitely have to make this an annual occurrence. Hey, I also wanted to follow up with our discussion on your marketing strategy and your interest in the Ferrazzi Greenlight loyalty strategy work we've done as a way to help reach your adult women demographic. When can you do a call this week, or at your leisure? Also, I wanted to say that I heard no fewer than 3 separate people talk about your session and what a great speaker you were. Congrats. Best, Keith. It's the people, not the speakers. You've probably already figured this rule out by now. I don't often find the content of conferences particularly useful. I read a lot. I think about these subjects constantly and talk to a lot of people. By the time I get to a conference, I know the substance of what's going to be said. Of course, there are exceptions, like when Michael Hammer talked about re-engineering and then would magically turn the talk into both a lesson in life and a stand-up comedy routine. Epiphanies aside, most conference speeches are about one more senior VP talking about his or her process improvement project. Even when the speaker is interesting, the mentality is the same. It's always about the people. Don't be this person. The wallflower, the limp handshake, the position in the far corner of the room, the unassuming demeanor, all signs that this person thinks he or she is there to watch the speakers. The ankle hugger. The ankle hugger is a total codependent and thinks that the first person they meet is their BFF, best friend forever. Out of fear, they shadow their BFF the entire conference. You've spent too much money not to leverage the opportunity to meet many different people, so bump. You have a lifetime to build relationships with these people. Collect as many follow-ups as you can. The celebrity hound. This type of person funnels every bit of their energy into trying to meet the most important person at the event. The problem is, if the person they want to meet truly is the most important person at the conference, that person will be on their guard, and maybe even guarded, literally. A young friend of mine went to see the King of Jordan speak recently and came back ecstatic. He had waited an hour or more, along with 500 other people, for a chance to shake the king's hand. I asked him, "How exactly did you benefit from that encounter?" "I can say I met him," he sheepishly replied. I told him that there were probably at least a handful of dignitaries and members of the king's cabinet in that room whom no one knew or wanted to know. Wouldn't it have been better for my young friend to actually have had a conversation with one of them instead of a handshake with someone who will not remember him beyond the handshake? Maybe he could have struck up a relationship. Instead, he got a photo and a handshake. The Smarmy Eye Darter. Nothing will give you a bad rap in less time. Be Bill Clinton instead. If you spend only 30 seconds with someone, make it 30 seconds of warmth and sincerity. Nothing will give you a good rap in less time. The Card Dispenser, Amasser. This guy passes his card out like it had the cure for cancer written on its back. Frankly, cards are overrated. If you perform the bump successfully and extract a promise for a future meeting, a piece of paper is irrelevant. This person gloats over the number of contacts he's made. In reality, he's created nothing more valuable than a phone book with people's names and numbers to cold call. Chapter 15. Connecting with Connectors. It has become part of our accepted wisdom that 6 degrees, or fewer, is all that separates us from anyone else in the world. How can that be? Because some of those degrees, people, know many, many more people than the rest of us. Call them super connectors. We all know at least one person like this individual who seems to know everybody and who everybody seems to know. You'll find a disproportionate amount of super connectors as headhunters, lobbyists, fundraisers, politicians, journalists, and public relations specialists, because such positions require these folks' innate abilities. I'm going to argue that such people should be cornerstones to any flourishing network. What Michael Jordan was to the basketball court, or Tiger Woods is to golf, these people can be to your network. So who are they, really? And how can you get them to become prize members of your circle of associates and friends? In his best-selling book, The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell cites a classic 1974 study by sociologist Mark Granovetter that surveyed how a group of men in Newton, Massachusetts, found their current job. The study, appropriately titled Getting a Job, has become a seminal work in its field, and its findings have been confirmed over and over again. Granovetter discovered that 56% of those surveyed found their current job through a personal connection. Only 19% used what we consider traditional job-searching routes, like newspaper job listings and executive recruiters. Roughly 10% applied directly to an employer and obtained the job. My point? Personal contacts are the key to opening doors. Not such a revolutionary idea. What is surprising, however, is that of those personal connections that reap dividends for those in the study, only 17% saw their personal contact often, as much as they would if they were good friends, and 55% saw their contact only occasionally. And get this, 28% barely met with their contact at all. In other words, it's not necessarily strong contacts like family and close friends that prove the most powerful. To the contrary, often the most important people in our network are those who are acquaintances. As a result of the study, Granovetter immortalized the phrase, "the strength of weak ties," by showing persuasively that when it comes to finding out about new jobs, or for that matter, new information or new ideas, weak ties are generally more important than those you consider strong. Why is that? Think about it. Many of your closest friends and contacts go to the same parties, generally do the same work, and exist in roughly the same world as you do. That's why they seldom know information that you don't already know. Your weak ties, on the other hand, generally occupy a very different world than you do. They're hanging out with different people, often in different worlds, with access to a whole inventory of knowledge and information unavailable to you and your close friends. Mom was wrong. It does pay to talk to strangers. As Malcolm Gladwell wrote, acquaintances, in short, represent a source of social power, and the more acquaintances you have, the more powerful you are. Throughout this book, I try to emphasize that what's most important is developing deep and trusting relationships, not superficial contacts. Despite Granovetter's research, I believe friendships are the foundation for a truly powerful network. For most of us, cultivating a lengthy list of mere acquaintances on top of the effort devoted to your circle of friends is just too draining. The thought of being obligated to another 100 or so people, sending birthday cards, dinner invites, and all that stuff that we do for those close to us, seems outlandishly taxing. Only for some, it's not. These people are super connectors. People like me, who maintain contact with thousands of people. The key, however, is not only that we know thousands of people, but that we know thousands of people in many different worlds, and we know them well enough to give them a call. Once you become friendly with a super connector, you're only 2 degrees away from the thousands of different people we know. A social psychologist by the name of Dr. Stanley Milgram proved this idea in a 1967 study. He ran an experiment that set out to show that our big impersonal world is actually quite small and friendly. It was Milgram's experiment that created the notion of 6 degrees of separation. In the experiment, he sent a package to a few hundred randomly selected people in Nebraska with the instructions that they forward the package to an anonymous stockbroker in Boston whom they did not know. Each person could send the packet only to someone whom they knew on a first-name basis and who they thought was more likely to know the stockbroker than they were themselves. About a third of the letters reached their destination after an average of only 6 mailings. What was surprising was that when all those chains of people were analyzed, Milgram found that a majority of the letters passed through the hands of the same 3 Nebraskans. The finding drives home the point that if you want access to the social power of acquaintances, it helps to know a few super connectors. Connectors can be found in every imaginable profession, but I'm going to focus on 8 professions where they most commonly congregate. Each of these kinds of connectors provides me with a link to an entire world of people, ideas, and information that, in a very significant way, has made my own life a little more fun, helped my career along, or made the businesses I worked for more successful. 1. Restaurateurs. 57th Street isn't exactly Lower Manhattan, but it was downtown to Jimmy Rodriguez, the nightlife impresario who made the Bronx hip for the A-list with his first eatery. Jimmy's Downtown, his second restaurant, lured the same set of celebrities, politicians, and athletes looking for good food and good times. When I was in New York, it was my spot. The scene was exclusive, without being pompous, soft light, a gleaming onyx bar, and a pumping R&B soundtrack made the place feel like a hip country club. Jimmy would fly around the tables hooking you up with free appetizers and introducing you to people he thought you might want to meet. It was like a private club without membership dues. My memories of Jimmy were of a true blue connector. In fact, it's a requisite for most people who own restaurants. When I was in Chicago, it was Gordon's Restaurant, and in L.A. it is Wolfgang Puck. The success of their enterprise depends on a core group of regulars who see the restaurant as a home away from home. And it's quite easy to get to know a restaurateur. The smart ones will go out of their way to make your experience delightful. All you have to do is reach out and go there often enough. When in a new city, I generally ask people to give me a list of a few of the hottest and most established restaurants. I like to call ahead and ask to speak with the owner, though the maitre d' will do, and tell them that I go out regularly, sometimes in large parties, and I'm looking for a new place to entertain a lot. If you don't go out as often as I do, find one or two restaurants that you enjoy and frequent them when you do go out. Become a regular. Make a point of meeting the staff. When you're entertaining for work, bring others there. When you have to cater an event, use them. Once you get to know the owner, it'll become like your very own restaurant, a place that has the patina of exclusivity and cachet, a private club in parts, with all the warmth and comfort of your own home. With some advanced planning and a little loyalty, a restaurateur will not only share the bounty of his kitchen with you, but introduce you to his roster of other clients as well. 2. Headhunters. Recruiters, job placement counselors, search executives. They are like gatekeepers. Instead of answering to one executive, however, the really successful ones may answer to hundreds of executives in the field in which they recruit. Headhunters are professional matchmakers, earning their wage by introducing job candidates to companies that are hiring. Should you get the job, the headhunter gets a sizable commission, typically a percentage of the successful candidate's first year's compensation. As a result, headhunters are an interesting blend of salesman and socialite. To find candidates, headhunters often place job ads. They also contact likely candidates directly, perhaps on the referral of a friend or colleague. In the industries in which they specialize, they become invaluable resources of names and information. The sweet spot for a headhunter revolves around two issues. You're either hiring them to do a search, or you're helping them to do a search on behalf of someone else. If you're in the market for a job, let as many search firms as are willing hit the phones for you. I keep a file of headhunters, who they are, and what they're looking for. And I return every call from them, helping to tap my network to find people for their jobs. I know they'll help me with access to some of their clients when I need their help. After all, they're in the networking business. Can anyone contact a headhunter? To be honest, headhunters prefer to be the one contacting you. But if you're careful about not trying to sell yourself before you offer up the network of contacts that you can provide to them, they'll be receptive. In the early years of my career, when I was not in the position of hiring them and didn't know people who were using search consultants, I would ask pointedly, "What searches are you working on? How can I help you find people?" The other advice in this area is to act as a pseudo-headhunter yourself, always on the lookout to connect job hunters and job seekers or consultants and companies. When you help people land a new gig, they'll be inclined to remember you if they hear of a new position opening. Moreover, if you help, say, a vendor of yours land a new client, they'll usually be more open to negotiating prices on your next project. Helping others find good employees is a real currency. 3. Lobbyists. Well-informed, persuasive, and self-confident, lobbyists are generally impressive networkers. By virtue of their job, they are intimately familiar with the ways of large corporations and how local and national government work. They are almost uniformly passionate people whose goal is to sway politicians to vote on legislation in a way that favors the interests they represent. How do they work? Lobbyists will often host cocktail parties and dinner get-togethers, allowing them to interact with politicians and their opponents in a casual atmosphere. Their more grassroots efforts involve long hours spent on the phone and in writing letters, trying to rouse the community to get involved behind an issue, all of which makes them a rather easy group to please. Can you hold an event for them? Volunteer your services. Refer other volunteers to their cause. Introduce them to potential clients. Lobbyists tend to bump up against a lot of people who it might be helpful to know, including those who are powerful and successful. 4. Fundraisers. Follow the money are words fundraisers live by. They know where it is, what it will take to get it, and most important, who's most likely to give it away. As a result, fundraisers, whether they work for a political organization, university, or nonprofit group, tend to know absolutely everybody. And while they have the unenviable job of trying to convince people every day to part with their well-earned money, they are almost always incredibly well-liked. It's a selfless job, often done for the best of reasons. And most people recognize that anyone who has a good friend who is a fundraiser has an open door to a whole new world of contacts and opportunities. 5. Public relations people. PR people spend the whole day calling, cajoling, pressuring, and begging journalists to cover their clients. The relationship between media and PR is an uneasy one, but at the end of the day, necessity brings them together like long-lost cousins. A good friend who works in PR can be your entree into the world of media, and sometimes celebrity. Ilana Weiss, who co-leads the PR firm I used called the Rose Group, introduced me to Arianna Huffington, the noted author and political columnist. Arianna has since become a friend and confidant, and one of the dazzling lights at my dinner parties in L.A. 6. Politicians. Politicians at every level are inveterate networkers. They have to be. They shake hands, kiss babies, give speeches, and go to dinners, all in the name of gaining the trust of enough people to get elected. The stature of politicians is derived from their political power rather than their wealth. Anything you can do to help them gain power with voters, or exercise power in office, will go a long way to ensuring you a place in their inner circle. What can a politician do for you? Local city hall politicians can be key to working through the thicket of local government bureaucracy. And politicians at any level, if successful, are celebrities, and their networks reflect that. How can you reach out? Join your local chamber of commerce. Local executives, business people, and entrepreneurs generally populate the chamber. In every community, there are plenty of young politicos looking to climb the political ladder. Early on, before their rise to prominence, you can engender a lot of loyalty and trust by supporting their goals and chipping in when they decide to run for office. 7. Journalists. Journalists are powerful. The right exposure can make a company or turn a nobody into somebody. Needy. They're always looking for a story. And relatively unknown. Few have achieved enough celebrity to make them inaccessible. For years, since I was back at Deloitte, I've called on journalists at different magazines taking them to dinners, and pumping them full of good story ideas. I now know people in top positions at almost every major business magazine in the country, which is one of the reasons why in less than a year after I took over Yaya, with barely a shred of revenue to its name, the company and, more important, the idea Yaya was trying to sell appeared in publications like Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, CNN, CNBC, Brand Week, Newsweek, The New York Times. The list goes on. 8. Authors, bloggers, and gurus. Social media and dramatic changes in the economics of publishing have given rise to a new category of super connector, the author guru. It used to be that publishers created celebrity authors through the sheer force of PR, imprimatur, and wide distribution networks. Now individuals create their own tribes to become the super connectors of their particular space online. Finding them isn't hard. Use tools like Alexa and Clout that measure influence to get a rough metric for who's dominating a particular space. Peruse Twitter for best of lists and to see who's most frequently retweeted, then become their most charming stalker. Connect to them in social media. Listen to what they're saying and over time weigh in. Once you know what would truly interest them, upgrade communications with a value-added email ping. Don't worry if you don't get a response. In a month, send another. Watch for opportunities to meet these people in person, at conferences, book signings, and other events. Creating even a weak tie to someone with a great deal of online influence, enough so they're willing to retweet you, will pay off big when you have news or a post you'd like to get some virtual eyeballs on. These are 8 different professions tailor-made for super connectors. Reach out to some. And there are others, lawyers, brokers, etc. Become a part of their network and have them become a part of yours. Cut the umbilical cord to the folks around the office water cooler. Mix it up. Hunt out people who look and act and sound nothing like you do. Seek out ideas from people you don't ordinarily talk to who inhabit professional worlds you don't ordinarily travel in. In one word, connect. In 4 better words, connect with the connectors. Connectors Hall of Fame Profile. Paul Revere, 1734 to 1818. Understanding Paul Revere's legacy to the world of networking is as simple as grasping the following. Some people are much more well-connected than others. If you moved to a small town and wished, for some reason, to meet everyone in town, what would you do? Go door to door, greeting one resident at a time? Or would you try to find one plugged-in resident who can open all the doors for you? The answer is clear. Today, that plugged-in townie might be, say, the high school principal, the Little League commissioner, or the church pastor. But in Paul Revere's day, think of the 1770s in the Boston metro area, the most plugged-in people were like Revere, the owner of a silversmith shop in the city's north end, businessmen and merchants who dealt with individuals at every level of Boston society and culture. Revere was also an extremely social individual. He formed several clubs of his own and joined many others. As a teenager, he and 6 friends formed a society of church bell ringers. As an adult, he joined the North Caucus Club, a society founded by Samuel Adams' father to choose candidates for local government. In 1774, when British troops began to seize munitions, Revere formed yet another club of sorts, responsible for monitoring the movements of British troops. In addition, Revere belonged to the Masonic Lodge of St. Andrew, through which he was friendly with revolutionary activists such as James Otis and Dr. Joseph Warren. All of which helps to explain why Revere, among all Bostonians in the year preceding the Revolution, served as courier for the Boston Committee of Correspondence and the Massachusetts Committee of Safety, writing express to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. It was also he who spread the word of the Boston Tea Party to New York and Philadelphia. Revere, in short, was a man who knew not only people, he knew gossip, he knew rumors, he knew news, and he knew it from every level of Boston society. In April 1775, Revere caught wind of British orders to capture rebel leaders and forcibly disarm the colonists. So Revere and his fellow rebels devised a warning system. Two lanterns shining from the steeple of Boston's Old North Church, the city's tallest building, indicated that the British troops were advancing on Boston by sea. One candle indicated a land advance. Either way, the rebels in Boston and its surrounding suburbs would know when and where to flee and take up arms. We all know the one if by land, two if by sea part of this story. What's less known is that Revere's networking savvy is what allowed him, and maybe only him, to be the one entrusted with illuminating the church steeple. The church, as it happened, was Anglican. The rector strongly supported the crown. But Revere knew the vestryman, John Pulling, through the North Caucus Club. And through his shop, he knew the sexton, Robert Newman, who had a key to the building. Revere's connections were crucial to him that fateful night. After lighting the lanterns, Revere needed to reach Lexington, to warn rebel leaders Sam Adams and John Hancock. First, two acquaintances rode Revere across the Charles River to Charlestown. There, a horse was waiting for Revere, lent to him by another pal, Deacon John Larkin. Chased by redcoats, Revere was diverted north of Lexington to the town of Medford. Because he knew the head of Medford's military, Revere rode to his house and warned him. With the militiaman's help, Revere alerted the town of Medford before heading to Lexington. Most of us know the Lexington part of the story. Less known is that on the same night that Revere made his midnight ride, a man named William Dawes went galloping off in the other direction to muster the militias to the west of Boston. Revere's ride stirred up an army, while something like three people showed up from the towns Dawes visited. Why? Revere was a connector. He knew everybody, and so was able to storm into one village after another, banging on all the right doors and calling out all the right people by name. Historians say Revere was blessed with an uncanny genius for being at the center of events. But it doesn't take genius for that, just involvement, an active interest in your community, and a friendship or two with a connector. Chapter 16. Expanding Your Circle. The most efficient way to enlarge and tap the full potential of your circle of friends is quite simply to connect your circle with someone else's. I don't think of a network of people as a net into which you wrangle contacts like a school of struggling cod, Again, it's like the Internet, an interconnecting series of links in which each link works collaboratively to strengthen and expand the overall community. Such collaboration means seeing each person in your network as a partner. Like a business in which co-founders take responsibility for different parts of the company, networking partners help each other, and by extension, their respective networks, by taking responsibility for part of the web that is theirs and providing access to it as needed. In other words, they exchange networks. The boundaries of any network are fluid and constantly open. Let me give you an example of what I mean from my own life. One Saturday afternoon, I went to join my friend Tad and his wife Caroline at the Hotel Bel Air in Los Angeles. Tad introduced me to Lisa, the manager of the hotel, who cuts a striking pose, tall, blonde, articulate, charming, funny, and casual, all at the same time. If between the two of you there's someone in L.A. you don't know, I'll be very surprised, Tad told us. In his eyes, we were both master networkers. Lisa was, as many in the hospitality business are, a super connector. Within 10 minutes of meeting each other, we knew we were going to be great friends. Lisa and I spoke the same language. Lisa had heard about the dinner parties I regularly threw for business. Your guests should be staying at the Bel Air during their L.A. jaunts, she told me. I, in turn, looked around the Bel Air and thought how memorable it would be to hold some of my events in such swanky surroundings. Could Lisa and I form a social partnership? So I made a simple suggestion. Lisa, let's share a few months of dinner parties. You hold a dinner party at the Bel Air and give me half the invite list. Then I'll hold one of my dinner parties and give you half the list. We'll split the tab for each event, saving each of us a bundle of money, and together we'll meet a lot of new, exciting people. By co-hosting the events, we'll make them that much more successful. Lisa agreed, and our dinner parties were a huge success. The unique mix of people from the worlds of business and entertainment was fun and interesting. Not only did we introduce our friends to an entirely new group of people, but the dynamic at the parties was exhilarating. Politicians, the inveterate masters of networking, have exchanged their networks in this fashion for years. They have what are called host committees, groups of people hailing from different social worlds who are loyal to a specific politician and charged with introducing their candidate to their respective circle of friends. A typical, well-established politician will have a host committee of doctors, lawyers, insurance professionals, college kids, and so on. Each committee is made up of well-connected people in their respective worlds who organize parties and events, granting the politician access to all their friends. To my mind, it offers a great template for people looking to expand their network. Are there worlds you want more access to? If so, see if you can find a central figure within that world to act as your own one-person host committee. In a business context, say you plan on selling a new product that your company is introducing several months down the line, and most of your customers will be lawyers. Go to your personal lawyer, tell him about the product, and ask him if he'd be willing to come with a few of his lawyer friends to a dinner that you'd like to host. Tell him that not only will he and his friends get an early look at this fabulous new product, but they'll have an opportunity to meet your friends who could become potential clients. They'll become responsible for holding events that will usher you into their group of friends. You'll become responsible for doing the same for them. This kind of partnering works wonderfully, but the underlying dynamic at work has to be mutual benefit. It should be a win-win for all involved. If you are sharing someone else's circle of friends, Be sure that you adequately acknowledge the person who ushered you into this new world, and do so in all the subsequent connections that they helped foster. Never forget the person who brought you to the dance. I once mistakenly invited a brand new friend to a party without inviting the person who introduced us. It was a terrible mistake, and an unfortunate lapse in judgment on my part. Trust is integral to an exchange of networks that demands treating the other person's contacts with the utmost respect. As your community grows, partnering becomes more of a necessity. It becomes a matter of efficiency. One contact holds the key to maintaining all the other relationships in his or her network. He or she is the gatekeeper to a whole new world. You can meet dozens, even hundreds of other people through your relationship with one other key connector. Two quick rules of thumb. One, you and the person you are sharing contacts with must be equal partners to give as much as you get. Two, you must be able to trust your partners because, after all, you're vouching for them, and their behavior with your network is a reflection on you. Word of caution. Never give any one person complete access to your entire list of contacts. This is not a free-for-all. You should be aware of who in your network is interested in being contacted and how. Exchanging contacts should take place around specific events, functions, or causes. Consider carefully how your partner wants to use your network and how you expect to use his. In this way, you'll be more helpful to the other person, which is the kind of genuine reciprocity that makes partnering and the world work. Chapter 17. The Art of Small Talk. We all have what it takes to charm everyone around us, colleagues, strangers, friends, the boss. But having it and knowing how to work it is the difference between going through life in the shadows and commanding center stage wherever you happen to be. So you weren't born with that essential ingredient of charm, the gift of gab. So what? Few are. We've all struggled with that ancient fear of walking into a room full of complete strangers and having nothing to say. Instead of looking out at a sea of potential new friends and associates, we see terrifying obstacles between us and the wet bar. It happens at business meetings, conferences, PTA meetings, and in just about every forum where being social matters. That's why small talk is so important. That's also why, for those of us without a knack for small talk, situations such as these can help us meet so many others, are also the situations that make us feel the most naked and uneasy. And in this area, technology hasn't helped one bit. Wallflowers see email and virtual chat as a nifty escape hatch from having to interact with others. The truth is, however, that these new modes of communication aren't particularly good for creating new relationships. The digital medium is all about speed and brevity. It may make communication efficient, but it's not effective when it comes to making friends. Yet some are able to negotiate social situations with relative ease. How do they do it? The answer, most people assume, is that the ability to make successful small talk is somehow innate, is something you're born with. While comforting, this assumption is entirely untrue. Conversation is an acquired skill. If you have the determination and the proper information, conversation, just like any other skill, can be learned. The problem is that so much of the information out there is flat-out wrong. I know too many CEOs who take pride in their terse bottom-line behavior. They proudly assert their disinterest in playing the game. They revel in their inability to be anything but gruff. But the fact is that small talk, the kind that happens between two people who don't know each other, is the most important talk we do. Language is the most direct and effective method for communicating our objectives. When playwrights and screenwriters develop characters for their work, the first thing they establish is motivation. What does the character want? What is he or she after? What are his or her desires? The answers dictate what that character will and won't say in dialogue. That exercise is not particular to the dramatic world. It's a reflection of how we humans are hardwired. We use words not only to articulate and make concrete our own deepest desires, but also to enlist others in quenching those desires. About 10 years ago, Thomas Harrell, a professor of applied psychology at Stanford University Graduate School of Business, set out to identify the traits of its most successful alumni. Studying a group of MBAs a decade after their graduation, he found that grade point average had no bearing on success. The one trait that was common among the class's most accomplished graduates was verbal fluency. Those that had built businesses and climbed the corporate ladder with amazing speed were those who could confidently make conversation with anyone in any situation. Investors, customers, and bosses pose no more of a threat than colleagues, secretaries, and friends. In front of an audience, at a dinner, or in a cab, these people knew how to talk. As Harrell's study confirmed, the more successfully you use language, the faster you can get ahead in life. So what should your objective be in making small talk? Good question. The goal is simple. Start a conversation. Keep it going. Create a bond and leave with the other person thinking, I dig that person. Or whatever other generational variation of that phrase you want to use. A lot has been said about how one should go about doing that. But in my opinion, the experts have gotten wrong the one thing that works the best. The first thing small talk experts tend to do is place rules around what can and can't be said. They claim that when you first meet a person, you should avoid unpleasant, overly personal, and highly controversial issues. Wrong! Don't listen to these people! Nothing has contributed more to the development of boring chit-chatters everywhere. The notion that everyone can be everything to everybody at all times is completely off the mark. Personally, I'd rather be interested in what someone was saying, even if I disagreed, than be catatonic any day. When it comes to making an impression, differentiation is the name of the game. Confound expectation. Shake it up. How? There's one guaranteed way to stand out in the professional world. Be yourself. I believe that vulnerability, yes, vulnerability, is one of the most underappreciated assets in business today. Too many people confuse secrecy with importance. Business schools teach us to keep everything close to our vest. But the world has changed. Power today comes from sharing information, not withholding it. More than ever, the lines demarcating the personal and the professional have blurred. We're an open-source society, and that calls for open-source behavior. And as a rule, not many secrets are worth the energy required to keep them secret. Being upfront with people confers respect. It pays them the compliment of candor. The issues we all care about most are the issues we all want to talk about most. Of course, this isn't a call to be confrontational or disrespectful. It's a call to be honest, open, and vulnerable enough to genuinely allow other people into your life so that they can be vulnerable in return. How many negotiations would have ended better